if he's telling the truth. Suppose he's still in his bedroom in Maryland playing a game. Well, I'll see soon enough. An incredibly ferocious rainstorm is approaching as we plow our way across Kansas, past signs promising ahead, rattlesnakes, prairie dogs, and a six-legged cat. I guess this is show business here in Kansas. I offer to get in the back on the floor with the dog, but Laura wants to stay there. She promises she's comfortable. The black clouds are getting ominous. Naturally, we talk about Dorothy, then discuss storm cellars, but never mention there's nowhere for us to go now if there is a tornado. Torrential rains hit. It's actually scary, but Mike is a great driver, and we make it through without flying off to some freaky local Oz. I see a junkyard that is exactly like the one I imagined in the Good Rive rave chapter. So perfect, so isolated, right smack dab in the middle of nowhere, with a trailer on the edge of the property where the owner must live. Wonder if he's cute. Suddenly, the sun is out, but it's still raining. Surely there must be a rainbow in these weather conditions, the three of us agree. But after searching the horizon on both sides of the interstate, we come up visually empty-handed. Maybe Kansas is fed up with all this Wizard of Oz bullshit. Maybe the state lawmakers have outlawed rainbows. I text the Corvette kid back that I will wait for him in Denver and will call from the hotel. If you haven't stopped to sleep, do so. I know he couldn't still be in his Corvette because that was his mother's car. So I add, I will wait for the Corvette kid no matter what you are driving. Will do, he answers. Kansas is scary long. Good God, he's gaining on us. I tell Mike and Laura about the Corvette kid, how he picked me up, and how now he is coming back, and I see they are too polite to ask, what the hell's going on here? I don't know the answer myself. All I know is I'm glad he's coming. It's not cheating. He's still a stranger giving me a ride. He's just picking me up for the second time. I feel so comfortable with Laura and Mike, even the dog. We pull off in Colby, Kansas, and have lunch at Montana Mike's. God, what a town. The wind is still howling. What could life possibly be like here in the dead of winter? We sit in a booth, and Mike and I order a big, fattening meal, while Laura is more health-conscious in her choice. I use the men's room, no graffiti, damn it, and pass an empty video game room, such a Nan Golden art shop. So sad, so lonely, so empty of fun. I try to imagine the bored, angry teens of this town in this pitiful room, and shudder at the potential hormonal violence this clubhouse from hell might provoke. I insist on paying for lunch. We keep going. God, this is such a great ride. My new family, Laura and Mike. They decide they'll stay in a motel in Denver, too, rather than keep going to their state park, where they actually aren't sure where they'll be camping. Since the Corvette kid is picking me up, it doesn't matter to me about exit or entrance ramps, so we can all stay in the same place. We cross into Colorado. Yay, mountain time! I've made it to the west. It doesn't look much different from Kansas for a while, though. Still sparse. Scary little towns I'd probably get stuck in if I didn't already have a ride. We even pull off and scope out the motels in the outskirts of Lyman, Colorado, but they seem spookily uninviting. We don't check in. Near Denver, it starts to look just like every other city does. Same chain shops and motels, but we don't care. We just need a room at the inn. We pull off and pick a place, La Quinta Inn, 4460 Peoria Street, which is in the city limits but near the airport. We unload, and Laura hides the dog in one of her bags to sneak him in. I know this is Mike and Laura's vacation, so I tell them, farewell, my new friends. I'm going to let you have a romantic dinner alone. We ask a stranger to snap our group photo on our respective cell phones, and he does, happily. I know my undercover travel adventure is still safe when he whispers to Laura, is that guy homeless? Laura laughs, and then as we go inside, asks me, were we the most boring people to pick you up? I honestly answer, are you kidding? You were perfect, and they are. Absolutely, undeniably marvelous people who give me faith in the kindness of strangers and the gifted new St. Christopher medal on my key ring. They rescued a dog and me. Real ride number 18. Corvette kid again. I check into my room and text the Corvette kid the exact address of the hotel. He texts back that his own car has a GPS so he can easily find the location, and he'll probably sleep before he continues driving. I answer back like a stern dad, you should. I've got time on my hands. Maybe I'll do laundry, wash those dingy underpants I haven't thrown away. I go down to the desk and ask if there's a laundromat in the hotel. Yes, the girl behind the counter says, surprising me. I didn't know these kind of places had washers and dryers available. I go up to where she instructed me and see it's just one room with nothing in it but a washer and dryer. No change machine, no soap. I race back down and she gives me both, and I stomp back up, throw in my underpants and a few t-shirts, sprinkle on the soap, and put in the quarters. But the machine jams. Now what? All my pitiful homeless clothes are covered with detergent. I go all the way back down and tell her, and she accompanies me back up with a paper clip. She attempts to jam the stack of quarters through, but is unsuccessful, goes back downstairs while I wait, and finally returns with a credit card, which she uses like a professional lock picker, and presto, the coins drop and the machine starts working. I thank her and figure it's safe to leave my clothes in the wash cycle, even though I had already fantasized stealing somebody else's laundry in one of the Good Ride chapters in the book. Reality is never as exciting as fiction. Back in my room, which is okay, better lighting than Holiday Inn, but not as good as Days Inn, I try to kill time but get bored and plod back up to the laundry room. This is the exact opposite of glamour. Naturally, the clothes are still sloshing around, so I just wait until they're done, alone. I don't use dryers because my t-shirts will shrink, but they'll never dry hanging in my bathroom overnight, so I toss them in with my clean underpants and hope for the best. I wonder if the Corvette kid pulled over to sleep. Do I pay for a separate room for him, or does he just take the other bed in my room? I have no idea what he expects. If I don't offer to pay for the room, does it look like I'm coming on to him, or just an innocent sleepover? Who knows, I think, as I gather my still slightly wet t-shirts and boxers and head back to my room. It's Saturday night in Denver. I'm going out. I go online and find out where The Dictator is playing. It just opened today all over America, and I purposely didn't read the reviews because I want to see this Sacha Baron Cohen movie first and make up my own mind. The girl at the desk tells me which theater is nearest. At first, I think maybe I'll hitchhike there, too, but then internally yell at myself, come on, you're off work tonight. This isn't part of your trip. Take a cab. I do. It's not far. I feel so alien in the backseat of a taxi. Am I now just a bourgeois passenger from the middle class, too dim-witted to hustle a free ride? The theater is located in some giant outdoor shopping center filled with young people. I am shocked how many fat teenagers I see. Really fat, 400 pounds fat, all with giant plates of alarmingly unhealthy food piled in front of them in outdoor cafes. I'm early, as always, so I search around for a more model-friendly type of eating establishment. I settle on the Euro Cafe and have a Mediterranean veggie roll and a bottled water. It is screamingly average, and although I am one of the few diners, the service is abysmal. Maybe they don't like thin people. I go into the movie theater, and I'm happy to see it is crowded. I take a seat on the aisle, and three presumably gay gentlemen pass me by taking their seats and recognize me, and I say hi back. I like the movie. It's so odd to be doing anything besides standing beside the highway, though, so I'm a bit uneasy throughout. As I file out afterwards, I run into the gay guys again, and one asks me why I'm in Denver. And I tell him I'm hitchhiking my way across the country. He says, well, do you want to ride back to your hotel then? And I say yes, with great enthusiasm, because technically I'm hitchhiking again, aren't I? I tell the guys that I'm staying at La Quinta Inn nearby, and the driver says he knows where that is. On the way, I discover one of my hosts owns a drive-in movie theater in Kansas. We talk about the isolation living in those tiny towns, and he fills me in on how tornadoes, some recently, had devastated many of the same places I had just driven through today. As he pulls up to La Quinta Inn to drop me off, I am momentarily confused. This doesn't look familiar, but what do I know? I'm in a different motel every night, and they all blend together. I hope this is the right one, I joke as I get out, unsure. Well, if it's not, you can always hitchhike, the drive-in owner wisecracks innocently. I get out. Fuck, it is the wrong one. I check my hotel key folder address, and sure enough, they've dropped me off at a different La Quinta Inn. I go inside in complete alarm, and the desk clerk calms me down. The one I'm staying in isn't that far away, and he'll get the guy that drives the airport hotel courtesy van to give me a ride back. I am greatly relieved, and of course, give the nice driver a tip for his kindness. Imagine my surprise when I play my phone messages and hear the Corvette kid's already here. He couldn't possibly have slept. I'm amazed he caught up to me this quickly. Come up to my room, I text. Damn, I already got a room, he replies. Well, that settles that. He texts he's going to take a shower first. I email Susan that the Corvette kid is here. A new chapter, so bizarre, she responds. There's definitely something strange about his race across the country. He may be one of those log cabin Republicans. The adventure continues, Susan signs off. Okay, now I feel better, the Corvette kid texts again, freshly showered. I could drive another 2,000 miles. Ah, youth, I text back. Did you eat yet, he asks. Yes, but I'll go with you if you're hungry, I reply. I'll be right down, he answers. Suddenly I think, suppose he's not here at all. Suppose all these texts have been a scam. Suppose no one comes down. No one knocks on the door. He could be laughing at me all the way from Maryland. But no, the Corvette kid delivers. He's here, dressed as wholesome as ever in his khaki shorts, T-shirt, and running shoes. But I can tell he's unsure if his look is cool enough for the road. It is, even if he is now driving a red Kia Sorento. I am happy to see him. We go out to look for something to eat, but everything is closed this late. We drive around as if we were casing fast food joints to rob until we finally settle for an open 7-Eleven, and he buys the most unappetizing pre-wrapped sandwich I've ever seen. I can see he's excited to be beginning the next leg of our crazy trip, and so am I, but I tell him he must be exhausted. He agrees, and I add that he should sleep as late as he can tomorrow morning. Back at the hotel, we split up to go to our separate rooms, and I tell him, you could have slept in the other bed without paying for your room. I'm not going to attack you. I'm too tired. He laughs out loud and goes up toward his new accommodations. I'm actually glad we have separate rooms. When was the last time I shared a motel room and wasn't sleeping with the person? Almost never. I decide that I'm going to just go as far as Reno with him, then get out for other rides and give him the keys to my apartment in San Francisco and tell him to drive there and wait for me. He's safe, I can tell. Even though we were supposed to be sleeping late, I wake up at 5:30 a.m. I'm so relieved I don't have to go outside and beg a ride. I see online on the Deadline Hollywood website news alert that Donna Summer has died. It's hard to care about celebrity news from a motel that doesn't even carry USA Today. I feel lazy just lolling around the motel room waiting for the Corvette kid to wake up. I take a bath and then panic when I realize I am out of La Mer cream. If ever I needed this pricey moisturizer, it's now. I look in the mirror and see I have hitchhiker face. Almost none of these motels ever offer complimentary body lotions. This one does, thank God, and I pocket it. Reduced to swiping cheap toiletries all in the name of literature. It's 10 a.m. and the Corvette kid is ready to go. He's freshly scrubbed, looks rested, and seems even more willing to take on his new role as my on-the-road sidekick. I fill up the tank and we're off. As soon as we get out of Denver, the landscape changes. The Rockies are suddenly so scary and beautiful. The Corvette kid laughs and admits he thought the Rockies were just one mountain we'd go over. We go through ski resorts with amazing vistas, and as excited as I am to see this kind of scenery again, after 40 years, it is even more fun to see it through the Corvette kid's eyes, especially when he's missing in action from his parents' home. We stop at a rest area and ask other tourists to take our pictures. I get recognized and sign autographs. If I had been hitchhiking, I bet it would have been easier to get picked up in Colorado than elsewhere. I like this state. We keep going, laughing, comparing stories about his life in a small town and mine as a filth elder. I immediately feel guilty for imagining anything gay about the Corvette kid. He's just a curious guy, and somehow we're suddenly in a book together. Could life be any better than this? We pull off in Grand Junction, Colorado, and make the mistake of having lunch at Applebee's. It's Sunday at 1:30 in the afternoon, and the eatery is packed with families and elderly people after church. The food is horrible, and I tell the kid that this gets the prize as the worst chain restaurant I've eaten in on the trip so far. I visit the men's room, and I'm shocked to see it's filthy. Middle America never looked so unappealing. We drive off and pass a middle-aged male hitchhiker, the first one I've seen this trip. We don't pick him up. I know. As soon as we drive across the Utah border, there's nothing. Beautiful nothing. Suddenly the check engine light comes on. If we break down here, we are incredibly screwed. It is hot as hell. No one is around. I have never even seen a cop. We just pretend that it's not on. Gas stations are few and very far between, as in, there aren't any. The kid's tank is getting low. Now that warning light comes on too. Check engine and no gas. I picture the vultures circling overhead. The kid suddenly points happily to a sign announcing a gas station coming up. We pull over with great relief to a Shell station in Thompson Springs, Utah. Gas is $4.14 a gallon. It was $3.19 in Kansas, but I guess they've got you by the balls here. There's not another one within hundreds of miles, so what are you going to do, not pay? The kid opens the hood to check the engine, just as his vehicle has ordered him to do, but I can tell he's no gearhead. The oil seems okay, he says, perplexed. Don't ask me. I don't even know how to open the hood of my car. We pull out and the check engine light is still on. We try not to talk about it. Route 70 West ends in about an hour, but Trish and I had mapped out with AAA the more direct route to 80 West by cutting up north on Route 191 to 6. This turnoff is about 10 minutes ahead. But looking out the window and at my AAA triptych and the Rand McNally Road Atlas, I realize these roads are almost entirely through the desert. What the hell? Let's take a chance. We turn off on 191, and it's just two lanes, one in each direction, where if you have to pass a car, you risk a head-on collision. The fucking check engine light is still on. It's so bleak that we both are energized by the extreme landscape. We see little baby dust tornadoes just hoping to become lethal ones. They may call this soil desert in these parts, but I thought a desert was sand. This is dirt. Once you veer west onto Route 6, you are in rattlesnake heaven. We pull through the coal mining town of Wellington, Utah, and I fall in love with this place. Such a weird little community. Tiny houses, sheds really, but painted in gay pastel colors. One little blue one was so sad yet proud, crumbling but imposing, that I wanted to move in. There's so many scary little churches, too. I picture Marjo-type preachers curing leprosy. It may be the best oddball city in America. I want to come back and have a vacation here one day. We stop in some convenience store and feel as if we are in the Twilight Zone. The Corvette kid pays for the snacks. I can tell he wants to get out of here. Fast. We drive north to Salt Lake City. Slowly, suburban life begins to come into view. We're making good time. Obviously, the check engine light is not warning us of anything dire. We've been driving all day at high speeds, and we're still going. We pull into Salt Lake City, which I know a little bit about from being here to promote my films. I even recorded the score for Serial Mom here. We look around for a motel. It's Sunday, luckily, so except for some Mormon art festival, the city is dead. We check into the Comfort Inn, and without discussing it, I pay for two rooms. I tell him to bring in all his stuff because we're in a city, and I'm always nervous someone will break into the car. I see he brought with him a real Republican preppy suit and regimental tie. It's hard for me to picture him dressed for his other life. We go into our separate rooms and agree to meet in the lobby to try to find a place to eat, somewhere that has real food. I text my office that I'm in Salt Lake City and that the Corvette kid is totally genuine, a sweet kid seeing America for the first time. I email my sisters. I'm in Salt Lake City. Send Mom love from the entrance ramps of America. The Corvette kid and I aimlessly walk the long blocks of Salt Lake City until we come to what looks like a fairly upscale Chinese restaurant. We enter, I get recognized, and they seat us outside at a nice table. The kid tells me his mother is absolutely horrified now that he has told her he is back with me. She is freaking. I again offer to talk with her, but he declines and turns off his phone so he can't see her frantic texts. I tell him I'm going to get out of his car in Reno and continue hitchhiking to San Francisco by myself. I'll give him my apartment keys. He can drive there on his own and stay until I arrive. He smiles in agreement, but says he is not telling his mom and dad that now. I confront him about the interview he gave to his hometown paper and how it said he was on his way to Joplin to help tornado victims the first time he picked me up, which wasn't true. He readily agrees and explained the paper got it mixed up. He had told the reporter he was supposed to go there about a week later. I believe him. We talk about our types. He admits the waitress at that Applebee's we ate at who wore tight jeweled pants was hot. So I mentioned how this one truck driver we had seen in a rest area looked pretty good to me. Earlier, when we had pulled into the lot of our Salt Lake City motel, he had checked the oil yet again, worrying about the check engine light, and I had cracked how butch he looked under the hood. He burst out laughing. He was getting used to my sense of humor. The Corvette kid picks up the dinner check. I knew he was a classy guy. As we walk back to the Comfort Inn, I see a lot of student types hanging out and say to the kid, go out by yourself if you want. Have some fun. I can tell he's been considering just that possibility, but I'm unsure if he actually will. We go to our rooms and promise to meet in the lobby early, a big day ahead of us. Nevada, here we come. I wake up too early and go down the hall to the dreaded breakfast room and see a Do Not Disturb sign on the Corvette kid's door. Oh, God, hope he didn't pick up a girl. I stop myself on that one. Why not? If he did, I hope she's pretty and smart. At least this breakfast room has some decent cereal. I eat and worry. Wouldn't he come here first to get something to eat before we check out? Oh, well, young people sleep longer. I take the elevator to the lobby and pace back and forth. As soon as the kid's 1 minute late, I picture him dead, cut up by some hooker. But a few seconds later, here he is, lugging all his bags back downstairs. He's unharmed, with a big smile on his face, ready to explore America. Yes, he went out, but nothing happened. Just hung out on the streets with some skaters and punk types who were all students. I'm glad he mingled. He's already had coffee in his room. We stop for gas, and I fill it up. We're both revved up. It's day 8 for me, and I'm feeling good. The kid is raring to go. Nevada, get ready. You are about to receive into your community the filthiest people alive. Hardly. I need to calm down. As soon as we drive out of town, the geography changes. The Salt Flats, Utah. Endless. Beautiful. Government training center, the sign says. To train what, we both wonder. Then we see our first mirage, the cheesy cinematic kind, where in the long, flat road ahead you see water, yet it disappears as you approach. Nevada must be getting nearer, because we see great signs for the first gambling town across the border, West Wendover. $10 lap dances. My God, what could those girls look like? Maybe this town is another future vacation spot for yours truly. Once we cross the state line into Pacific time, I see the first and possibly the cheesiest gambling casino in the state. Its sign reads, The Nugget, Free Truckers, 7 days a week. The kid and I marvel at this offer. Does it mean truckers can stay there without paying forever as long as they gamble? Imagine how exciting and dramatic and terrifying this place would be. A photo op that would raise Diane Arbus straight out of her grave. We see a sign for a town coming up, actually called Oasis, Nevada. When we pull through this, I would imagine once highly anticipated burg, all that is left off the freeway are about 5 dilapidated buildings, deserted, rotted, and boarded up. What happened? Are there squatters inside? What a perfect village. Its name itself is a lie. We stop for gas in Valmy, Nevada. Talk about local color. The cashier behind the counter, a tough desert mall if there ever was one, looks as if she just ate a pound of nails for breakfast. The decor seems done by Vincent Perenio, who production designed all of my movies. 2 pitiful slot machines are inside. The kid and I both play, and we both lose. Has anyone ever won here? As we're going back to the car with our meager snack purchases, we see one guy and 2 ladies exiting their vehicle, who appear to have stepped straight out of one of my screenplays. Pushing middle-aged, but definitely not settled, they're on their way, you can tell, to some kind of wild fun. Especially the dame with the extremely dyed blonde hair and the stilettos. Are they swingers? They give us a big grin as they pass us in the parking lot, but I'm not sure if they recognize me or are just looking to make friends. The Corvette kid and I smile back and then look at each other slightly bug-eyed in surprise before I fill up the tank. Gas is $4.69 a gallon, a new high. I look in the road atlas to see where we are, but Valmy is not on the map. We turn on the radio and not one AM or FM radio station comes on. The check engine light continues to add a touch of anxiety, but we've risen above that. Just that we're still moving is proof we're okay. I wish there were highway signs that read, no services, no name, no such thing, because that is exactly our location. We're starting to feel starved, but there aren't even bad chain restaurants on this highway. Eventually, we see a sign for a town coming up called Lovelock, Nevada. Sounds good to me, like Love Lips or Lip Lock. There's a prison there, too, which always makes me feel included. We pull off and instantly feel as if we've been cast in a cowboy movie. Lovelock is like a set for the Wild West, only it's real. We drive around and pass the Cowpoke Cafe. How can we not stop? A perfect name for a perfect place. Inside is even better. It's decorated like the Long Branch Saloon in Gunsmoke. Home-cooked food, too. I'm shocked when a big, big lady approaches me and asks for an autograph. I pose for a picture with her, and the kid takes it. We sit down to eat, and it is delicious. My chicken soup is the best meal I have had on the trip, by far. The kid and I look startled when the swingers we saw back in Valmy enter for lunch, too. Wow, are they following us, I wonder, before realizing this is such a great place. Maybe every traveler on the highway is in on the secret but us. I go outside to take a phone call from my office and update them on my whereabouts. They are happy I'm with the kid and inform me that the Kansas couple have Facebook pictures from our ride, and now these have gone viral too. I quickly check my Google alerts, and I'm both horrified and I guess flattered to see some company has already manufactured and offered for sale for $19.99 a hitchhiking bull denim tote bag with my End of 70 West sign pirated from the Facebook picture. Jesus. Back inside the Cowpoke Cafe, the Corvette kid informs me he's been talking to the swingers, and they did recognize me, and he's given them his phone number because they want to get together with us in Reno. I can tell the kid is flattered by their attention. Maybe he doesn't get hit on back in small-town Maryland. He's shy, I realize, unsure of his sex appeal. I'm happy this trip is building his confidence, but suddenly I feel like the conservative relative. God knows what they have in mind, I wonder. A little granddad, grandson, five-way? I roll my eyes and grab the check. Come on, kid, we're leaving. We keep going. Lots of brush fires in the desert, and nobody even there to put them out. Some of them are big, too. Oh, well, I'm not Smokey the Bear, but obviously no one listened to him. We're getting near Reno, the biggest little city in the world, a place for which I have low expectations. We pull off in Sparks, Nevada, the town before Reno, which seems somehow shabbier than how I had imagined it with Connie Francis. One of the swingers has just texted the Corvette kid that we should hook up here and party. I am slightly shocked. He gives me a shit-eating grin and chuckles. We pull back on the highway and continue into Reno, auditioning entrance ramps for dropping me off on the final hitchhiking leg in the morning. None look promising. Too inner city. I bet the cops are strict here. We drive around looking for a hotel. It looks depressing. The people in the street seem beaten down, old. We pull into the parking lot of a big-name casino hotel and go in to check prices and see if they have a vacancy. The stench of cigarette smoke is overpowering. I literally gag from the odor, and I'm not even born again about people who still smoke. Rollo, the middle-aged doorman supporting giant mutton chops, instantly recognizes me and escorts me to the proper check-in line. He's a gay blade, all right, and says he will take care of anything I need. It's only $29 a night? Good God, what could the rooms be like? I go out and get the Corvette kid, and as usual, warn him to take all his bags inside since the parking lot is uncovered. Rollo's eyes light up when he gets a load of my traveling companion, and suddenly I feel like such a chicken queen. When we check in, the clerk doesn't even ask the Corvette kid's name. What, do they just write trick on the registration? Naturally, I pay for two separate rooms, like the Daddy Warbucks they think I am. We walk through endless casinos with Rollo as our guide to find the proper elevator to get to our accommodations. So many old people, so much emphysema, so many cigarettes, so little time. God, it's depressing to see the blank looks of these elderly retirees yanking down the handles on the slot machines and barely registering any emotion, no matter if they win or lose. Our rooms down the hall from each other are not bad. We've asked for non-smoking, but the toxic cigarette smoke is so overwhelming in this hotel that you'd have to hermetically seal off each room and fumigate for a year before you could even begin to promise such a thing. I'll be sleeping in a moderately designed ashtray for the night. The kid says that before we go down to explore and eat dinner, he has some city council work to do and wants to give another interview to a different hometown newspaper. I tried to warn him that the fact he has come back to get me may raise a few eyebrows, but he just laughs. But as soon as I'm back in my room, I get a frantic call from the Corvette kid on my cell phone. He's locked himself out. Seems old Rollo brought up a VIP platter of cheese and fruit, but instead of delivering it to my room, knocked on the kid's and came into his room. Odd, Rollo knew which was my room and which was the kid's. I rescue the kid from the hall, and he's unnerved. First, he never knew that management often sends up such food items to welcome hotel guests if they are famous in any way. Plus, it's further unsettling that Rollo seemed a little too familiar in his in-room patter, never mentioning the curious delivery to the unfamous room. The kid even locked his wallet with ID in his room, so I have to call downstairs and get Rollo to bring up a new key. He returns and asks to take a photo of us holding the VIP tray. The Corvette kid is now chuckling. Here's the blackmail photo. The two of us in the honeymoon suite of the hotel. I shoo Rollo away after thanking him for keeping such a good eye out for us. The kid is still laughing, but he tells me his mom is stunned when he informs her that we are now in Reno together. I guess it does look bad. The hotel thinks I've checked in with some boy, and his parents think he's run off with a pornographer. Plus, I'm a Democrat. Even the kid's friends are contacting him nervously about his adventure. Way to go, one has texted. You're with a gay man in a hotel room in Reno? We roar. It's completely innocent, but highly troubling to everybody but us. A bromance is not an easy thing to explain. We walk out of the hotel at a different exit to avoid Rollo. He's a funny guy, but yikes, a little overeager. The streets are mostly empty except for the sketchy homeless. Long blocks of nothing except cheapo hotels and tawdry gambling casinos that look understaffed and ready to go out of business. Then we turn the corner and see cop cars with lights flashing and a small crowd of rubberneckers. In the street is a body with a sheet over it. Some kind of shootout, I gather. We stroll by. We enter another casino and try to get change to play the slot machine. I'm amazed to hear the woman in front of me in line say to her female friend, "God, I love it here." I am stunned by this unironic remark. What could she possibly love about it? The smoke? The humiliation of losing? The free watered-down drinks? The pathetic glamour of faux richness that even she could certainly not believe? We start playing one-armed bandits. The kid loses a few dollars, but every once in a while I win. How humiliating. Those dreaded sound effects of coins dropping, flashing lights, and the very public display of winning such paltry change. I go back and forth within my $20 limit, getting down almost to zero when I win again and suddenly have a $20.25 balance. I cash out. Mr. Lucky, I beat this town. Even the Corvette kid seems shocked at my gambling self-discipline. We walk back into the disheartened streets of Reno. The dead body is still there. We look for a place to eat, but the pickings are slim. A lot of chain places. Finally, we stumble upon a restaurant that advertises organic. Campo Restaurant, a jewel among the riffraff. We go inside and see cute people. No cigarette smoke. The hostess recognizes me and seems speechless I've wandered in. We get a nice table, and I order skirt steak, and the Corvette kid has organic chicken salad. The owner stops by to say hello, and I tell him I'm hitchhiking across the country. The waitress is nice, too, a lovely fan. She asks, "What are you doing after dinner?" And I politely say, "We can't see the good local bars because we have to get up early." I'm now used to saying "we" and forget what she is probably thinking. Christ, John, how old is he? The kid and I have promised to have a celebratory martini once we both land safely in San Francisco. We can't do the town now. Not yet. We stroll back to the hotel. It's dark out now. The dead body is still there. Is there some kind of strike at the local police morgue? The streets don't feel exactly dangerous. I am from Baltimore, after all. But neither the kid nor I feel like exploring any further. We enter the hotel by yet another door, hoping to avoid the services of Rollo. Alone in my room, I think how safe I've been the whole trip. Not one scary ride, not one bad driver, not one car accident, not one incident of police harassment. My AAA triptych has been very helpful, and the Rand McNally Road Atlas is my manual to hitchhiking success. And my BlackBerry, my love, my life, will you marry me, I ask? Yes, thank you, and good night. I awake to the stench of the hotel cigarette smoke and realize today, day 9, could be my last day on the road if I'm lucky and get a ride quickly once the kid lets me out at a new hitchhiking ramp. I've studied the maps, and I'm pretty sure it's a bad idea to try for a ride in Reno. A town called Truckee is about 15 miles away, right across the California border, which looks promising. Besides, I like the name, Truckee. My kind of town? I'm so optimistic I throw away two more pair of worn boxer shorts and a pair of dirty socks. I'm excited to see that for once the hotel I'm staying in has room service. I talk to the kid on the hotel phone and tell him to order in too. He surprises me by laughing and telling me that Rollo called his room late last night and asked if he needed anything. Like what, a blowjob, I wonder? He was still working in that hour, I marvel. No, he called me on my cell phone, the kid answers. You gave him your cell phone number, I roar. Well, yes, he mumbles, realizing how naive he could be. Let's get the hell out of here, I say to the kid, and he agrees. We have breakfast, awful, and check out. In the car on the way to Truckee, the kid tells me that he told his mom this morning he was headed to my apartment in San Francisco, and he will be staying there, even though I will not be arriving until later. Stunned silence on her part. Repeat what you just said on speakerphone so your father can hear. She managed to sputter, he tells me. The kid seems bewildered in a humorous way that his family is so concerned. Me too. We're just appearing on a reality show that's not being filmed. Why is everybody not tuned in? We pull off Route 80 in Truckee, and I like what I see. It's ski country. Beautiful. Evergreens, mountains. It's clear and crisp out. Plus, there's a bridge right nearby that I could go under if it starts raining. I hand the Corvette kid my keys. My office has already called ahead and told my doorman in San Francisco to let him in and give him a parking space in the garage. It's weird getting out to hitchhike again after the comfort of being with such a good traveling companion on the highway. We bid farewell, and I look forward to seeing him again in San Francisco at our journey's end. He pulls off. I wish I could somehow get there first. I stand there for a while, but I don't get that sinking feeling the way I usually do at the start of every hitchhiking morning. I'm in California. The drivers I see look either upscale liberal or hippie-friendly. It's only been about 10 minutes, but a car has already pulled over. I grab my bag hopefully, but instantly realize it's the Corvette kid again. I'm sorry, he yells. I knew you'd think a new person had stopped, but I forgot to take a picture of you hitchhiking. I could kill him for a second, but then laugh and give him my best hitchhiking pose. He snaps the photo, honks affirmatively, and pulls away, totally unafraid to enter phase 3 of our time together. I had asked the Corvette kid earlier in the hotel, if they make a movie out of my book, who do you want to play you? Justin Bieber, he announced without even hesitating. Real ride number 19, restaurant owner and wife. I don't stand there for long. I get a ride. Behind the wheel is a cool guy wearing sunglasses, and beside him is a pregnant woman who is just as sexy and confident. I say, hi, I'm John Waters. And he says, hi, I'm Mark, and this is my wife, Allie. And you ate in my restaurant last night in Reno. Unbelievable. He even remembers what I ordered for dinner. Yes, he had stopped by our table, and I had told him I was hitchhiking. But he had no idea I'd be doing so 30 miles outside of town in Truckee, California at this time or location. What a fluke. Mark and Allie are on their way to Napa for a week's vacation and agree to take me all the way there. Yay, 160 miles or so. Their restaurant compo had been the only bright spot in Reno for me, so I feel guilty thinking so negatively of the town as Mark explains. Reno is on the upswing. He tells me his bistro is all organic and only uses meat from local butchers. Vegetables are grown nearby, too. You can tell he's a real foodie, yet rugged in a Western way. Obviously, he is a famous chef here and a community activist anytime farming is mentioned. Allie was originally from the Pacific Heights neighborhood in San Francisco, and you can tell she is a thoroughbred. We stop in Granite Bay, California to get gas, and I offer to fill it up or buy them lunch, but they decline, saying we wouldn't take anything from a normal hitchhiker, so we're not taking anything from you. We talk about mountain roads, and I mention my obsession with emergency truck escape ramps, usually located on a steep, sustained downhill grade in elevated areas. The kind of exit lanes that just veer off the interstate and are graded up a hill, so if a truck's brakes fail going down, the driver, in a last-ditch effort, just aims into this escape lane and prays the upgrade will slow down his rig and soften the impact of the upcoming crash. Mark tells me the story of a friend who built his house on property right on the other side of one of those mountain emergency stops in Incline Village, Nevada. Never having actually seen a truck use one of these lanes, despite living in the Rockies his whole life, Mark's friend figured what the hell. He'd build a house here on Mount Rose anyway. Maybe that's why he got such a good deal on the property. But the unthinkable did happen. A runaway truck lost its brakes, and the driver veered into the lane, hoping for the best. The best didn't happen. The entire truck smashed, flipped over, landed on Mark's friend's house, exploded, and killed all his pets. His daughter did see it coming, imagine that horror, and ran out just in time and lived. Mark said his friend never got over it. No wonder. I'm so excited. I almost start belting out the lyrics to Runaway Truck by Red Simpson, that wonderfully descriptive hillbilly tune with a chorus, dangerous curves all around, but decide to spare my host, my unmelodious singing voice. We keep going on Route 80, past their intended turnoff, so Mark can find me a good rest area to hitch. We go even further, and I feel guilty they're going so far out of their way. But we finally find the perfect one, Hunter Hill Safety Roadside Rest Area. And it has a view. In the distance, I can actually see the Golden Gate Bridge. I can almost taste San Francisco. Mark and Allie drop me off at the parking lot exit hitchhiking spot, and Allie takes a photo of Mark and me. Naturally, I'm holding my prop, the new 80 West San Francisco sign that I made in my hotel last night. We wave goodbye, and I know I'm going to make it. I'm almost there. Real ride number 20, Reluctant Air. It's a busy rest area, and for once I'm not worried. I'm going to get a ride here easily. I can just feel it. From my viewpoint, I can see all those who exit their vehicle and walk to the restroom. By their expression, you can tell if they're going to shit or piss, and I try to predict the bathroom activity of each and receive the verdict by how long they stay inside. I don't have time to play my little toilet game long, though. I get a ride right away. In a van packed with camping equipment, a canoe, maybe even a dog and a kennel, I don't look back for long. The Reluctant Air type who picks me up is the perfect Bay Area man. A handsome, seemingly one-time hippie. A 56-year-old guy who spends most of his time camping and lives between Washington State and the Bay Area in this van and is on the way to pick up my mom at the Oakland airport. You can tell he's been around but has good breeding, nice cheekbones, uses proper grammar. Even though I imagine my ride is straight, a checkered history with both women and mental health issues, I'd bet, he reminds me of one of my first boyfriends, Tom Hausman, who also at the time was a boyfriend of my best female friend, Pat Moran. Sadly, Tom overdosed in the 70s, but Pat and I are still best friends. My driver confides, I had a DUI in the past. I like ecstasy, and I still do LSD. God, I think, maybe I should take LSD again. Could that be my next book? I'll retake every drug I ever took, in order. Hash, pot, LSD, amphetamine, morning glory seeds, glue, heroin, MDA, opium, mushrooms, and cocaine. And then do bath salts? Maybe not. Old money plus drugs plus manners equals a man who is compassionate. He tells me about the homeless family he had been talking to in the rest area before he picked me up. A black and white straight couple with two kids who had a meth head roommate who drove them out of their house and now, even though they had nowhere to go, were having a picnic in the roadside rest area. What great optimists. Why can't we all be this happy in the face of sudden misfortune? Is this what my rider is trying to tell me? Or am I just liberally profiling the man behind the steering wheel? How do I know what I'm surmising about this guy is true? Maybe he's planning on killing his mother once he picks her up at the airport. Doesn't really matter, though, because since he's not going into San Francisco, he asked me at which exit I'd like to be dropped. University Avenue exit in Berkeley, I shout happily. If I can't get a ride here, I ought to shoot myself. Real ride number 21. Craigslist pull. Ah, the great Bay Area weather. It's chilly as I walk over to the entrance ramp. I am ecstatic. Will this be my last ride, or will I have to actually hitchhike locally once I do get a lift into the city of San Francisco? I put out my best hippie vibes, and it works. Another great guy in a van picks me up. He doesn't recognize me until I get in. He explains that he hasn't picked up a hitchhiker in 10 years and thought at first, like everybody else, that I was a homeless beggar. He was surprised I wasn't standing at the intersection like other panhandlers. Why would he be begging this far down the ramp, he debated in the split-second decision it took him to pull over and stop. His name is Paul, and he is yet another cool, kind, middle-aged married guy. He is on his way into the city to pick up a table he bought on Craigslist. When I ask him where, he gives me an address 2 blocks from my apartment. "Yes, you are my last ride," I tell him with excitement. "If you're not a killer," he says with a hint of seriousness. "Don't worry, I'm not," I assure him as we stop at the Bay Bridge toll booth. I am so happy to pay that I don't even get a receipt. Paul is English, but he has been living in this country for 20 years. He says he used to hitchhike in London myself until people stopped picking me up. I feel incredibly safe as the breathtaking panorama of the San Francisco skyline that no one could ever get sick of comes into view. I immediately visualize that great YouTube clip of Judy Garland singing San Francisco on her 1963 TV show. And once you've seen it, you'll understand how crazily focused, insanely optimistic, and spiritually privileged I feel at this exact moment in my life. I call my friend Vincent Fectu, who has agreed months ago to be on hand to snap the photo of my final ride and me outside my apartment building. Vincent said he's on his way, but when we hang up, I wonder how he'll ever get there first. He travels by bicycle, and we are making great time. There's no traffic. Paul and I pull into the city and drive by the bus stops I use daily here, my training ground for this finally about to be completed hitchhiking trip. I almost feel giddy, shocked that I've actually done this. From my Baltimore house to the door of my San Francisco apartment building, the book pitch is finally going to be a reality. We pull up and Vincent is not there yet. That's okay. I'll get the doorman to take the photo. I can't expect Paul, who seems game, to stick around forever for a photo shoot. I barge into the lobby, still carrying my sign, and there's a doorman I don't really know as well as the others. I must look unreasonably excited, beyond nuts. He eyes my sign quizzically as I hastily explain I've just hitchhiked across the country and asks, "Would you take my photo outside with my last ride if the guy who was supposed to show up to take it doesn't arrive soon?" The doorman agrees without comment, maybe thinking I'm kidding. I call my office and tell Susan and Trish I have arrived. They seem incredibly relieved and send out an email to all my friends. He just called from the lobby of his building in San Francisco. He made it. I go back outside and know Vincent, so I figure let poor Paul go pick up his table. His ride was a short but momentous one for me. I can't hold up the gracious, good-humored man's life much longer. I get the doorman, and Paul and I pose beside his van as I hold my 80 West San Francisco sign for the final time. The doorman snaps a few different shots, and it's done. Paul chuckles at the whole situation, and we shake hands goodbye, and he pulls off. I walk stunned inside my building to the elevator. The Corvette kid is safely inside my apartment, sitting in the dark, seemingly too nervous to touch anything, even a light switch. Vincent shows up and laughs at the missed photo opportunity, and I introduce him to the Corvette kid. It's almost as if I don't know how to act or speak anymore back in my real life. Susan emails me that if it was my unknown ass, I'd still be hitchhiking in West Virginia. I check my San Francisco answering machine and hear Mink Stoll sobbing in relief that I made it. I am moved and shocked to realize that she was this concerned. I weigh myself. I have lost 1 pound. Playlist. Go ahead, find them online and listen. Number 1, Hitchhike by Marvin Gaye. Number 2, Transfusion, Nervous Norvis. Number 3, Looking at the World Through a Windshield by Del Reeves. Number 4, The Giggler, Pat and the Wildcats. Number 5, Locomoto by Cornbread and Jerry. Number 6, Witch Doctor, David Seville and the Chipmunks. 7, Chain Gang, Bobby Scott. 8, Travelin' Boogie by Zeb Turner. Number 9, Swingin' Down the Lane, Jerry Wallace. Number 10, Hot Wheels by Stan Farlow. Number 11, Flying Saucer, Rock and Roll by Billy Lee Riley. 12, Vacation, Connie Francis. Number 13, Hitchhiker by Bobby Curtola. 14, Bumming Around, Jimmy Dean. 15, There Stands the Glass by Webb Pierce. 16, Hitchin' and Hikin' by Johnny C. 17, You Are the Finger of God by the Addicts. Number 18, Torture, the Everly Brothers. Number 19, Tofurkey Song, Joni Leeds. Number 20, I'm a Lone Wolf by Leon Payne. 21, Riot in Cell Block Number 9 by the Robins. 22, Strychnine, the Sonics. 23, Lonesome Drifter by Jericho Brown. 24, Jingle Bells, the Singing Dogs. 25, Cross Ties by Dale Hawkins. 26, Babysittin' Boogie by Buzz Clifford. 27, Who Killed Teddy Bear by Josie Cotton. 28, Ohio, Doris Day. 29, Runaway Truck by Red Simpson. 30, San Francisco, Judy Garland. Acknowledgements. Of course, I would like to thank my two assistants, Susan Allenback and Trish Schwiers, not only for being characters in this book, but also for running Hitchhiker Central in my office for the 2.5 years it took to write and live this adventure. They did endless research, sometimes on joyful subjects, but more often on hideous ones, without the blinking of an eye, or at least ones I saw. Trish plotted my fictional geographical route better than AAA ever could have, and Susan tracked down devices to safely monitor me and force me to realize that I had to go shopping for sensible hitchhiking supplies before I left, non-fictionally. Once I was out on the highway, they were my lifeline to reality and were there for me in times of despair. More importantly, they kept the secret of my hitchhiking trip until after it had been completed. Both typed the manuscript from my Twombly-esque handwritten first drafts, and most embarrassing for me, had to read the sex parts concerning their own boss. Susan commented it was hard for her to tell the difference between the best that could happen parts and the worst in the fictional sections of this book. Susan and Trish are both incredibly skilled at editing and did so with me endlessly before we turned in the manuscript to the publisher. Karsick is their book, too. The music playlist was also a group effort. Larry Benishevitz, who has helped me find music for all my movies and the A John Waters Christmas and A Date with John Waters CD compilations, led me to hitchhiking songs I never knew existed. Pauline Fisher and Mike Page also found me tunes that made the final cut. Jill Fannin hunted down all the selections online and made me endless versions of Karsick's soundtrack so I could audition each number. My literary agent, Bill Clegg, was the first to hear of my hitchhiking idea, but I begged him not to reveal it yet to Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux because first I wanted to be sure I had the nerve to do it. He kept nagging me to at least let him tease the concept, and I vaguely said yes, and the next day called to say they wanted to do it. Gulp. This is my second book with FSG, and I'm spoiled. What a great team. Jonathan Galassi, my editor, never doubted I'd make it, and when I was halfway through the trip, stuck on some godforsaken entrance ramp, his encouraging texts were all I needed to keep going. Susan Goldfarb is a patient and expert production editor. I challenge you to find even one typo in Role Models, and working with her again was a privilege. Ellis Levine gave me focused legal advice, and every time I do a book with him, I learn. I'd also like to thank him for never mentioning my singing asshole in our discussions in a legal or non-legal way. But more than anything, I'd like to praise the drivers who picked me up. If I ever hear another elitist jerk use the term flyover people, I'll punch him in the mouth. My riders were brave and open-minded, and their down-to-earth kindness gave me new faith in how decent Americans can be. They are the only heroes in this book. This is John Waters. We hope you enjoyed this production of Karsick. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt and Laura Wilson. Recorded by Bob Bragg. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Text copyright 2014 by John Waters. Production copyright 2014 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. P.S. Thanks for the lift.